All right. So again, we're going to start Amos 7 tonight. And starting in Amos 7, things get mixed up a little bit. There's kind of a change that happens. And if you look on in your class book there on page 4, or the second page of your class material, if you got the paper copies of the class materials, there's a box at the top that just says seeing the big picture. And before we actually dive into chapter 7, I just want to make sure that we're seeing what's going on in the larger picture of Amos's book here as it's been compiled for us. Because we're going to have, really for the rest of the book, except for the very end, the last few verses at the end, you've got this series of visions that Amos has. A series of 5 visions. And they're laid out here very carefully, I think purposefully. They're organized this way in the book. You've got the first and second vision that starts off chapter 7. We're going to look at those two tonight. But then you have a third vision in verses 7 through 9. But then you've got this break. You have this narrative section in the book of Amos, which is something we haven't seen thus far. It's only been just a collection of Amos's oracles. But at the middle of chapter 7, you're going to have this narrative episode that is really representative of the type of opposition that Amos received while he was trying to minister to the northern kingdom. And that really does 2 things, that narrative episode. One, it illustrates, looking behind it, it illustrates why Yahweh said in vision 3 that he would destroy the high places, sanctuaries, and rise against the house of Jeroboam. So it helps to illustrate why that was the case from vision 3. But kind of like a door, you know, this narrative interlude is kind of the hinge on which these visions are organized. It also looks forward to visions 4 and 5 because it sets up vision 4 and the subsequent onslaught of judgment oracles that are then going to take place after that narrative episode occurs. Pardon me, I forgot to spit out my gum before. Let me turn around here. That's a big no-no in the corporate training world. You don't speak with gum in your mouth. Okay, so while we're going to zoom in on Amos chapter 7, and really it's going to take us 2 classes to do so, I just don't want us to lose sight of what's going on at the end of this book, because these visions are going to communicate certain themes and messages in a very unique way that's just going to add to the color and the nuances of Amos's book for us. So let's go ahead and start with chapter 7. So we're just going to look at the first vision in Amos 7. And we're going to say a few things about it. So let's just read together the first 3 verses of Amos 7 where we are given this first vision that is shown to Amos. This is what the sovereign Yahweh showed me. He was preparing swarms of locusts after the king's share had been harvested and just as the late crops were coming up. When they had stripped the land clean, I cried out, "Sovereign Yahweh, forgive! How can Jacob survive? He is so small." So Yahweh relented. "This will not happen," Yahweh said. And we'll just stop there to kind of meditate on this first vision so far. So here, as we're starting out this series of visions by Amos, this first vision is going to be Yahweh is preparing a judgment of locusts. A judgment of locusts. Now, it's important that we remember the locusts are the instrument of the judgment, but Yahweh is the agent of the judgment here. Yahweh is the one behind this judgment he's bringing on his people. Locusts aren't really something that get an emotional rise out of us. You know, we read this, and if you're like me, there's no real emotional impact when you read about this plague of locusts. But just remember the society and the culture that we're talking about. If you live in this agrarian, this ancient Near Eastern agrarian society, where your food source is what you grow, and all of the months and labor that you put in to planting your crop and harvesting it, all of that work isn't just for fun. It's because that's your food. That's how your family is going to be able to eat. And so if you look at the bottom right of your class materials there on page 4, there's a picture there of just a swarm of locusts where it's even starting to kind of distort the sunlight there. You especially can see it if you have the book in the color copy. So just imagine you've put in all these months of work into your crops, and the harvest has come. It's almost time for you to now glean the things that you've worked for and have this food source. And then this plague of locusts comes through and just wipes out everything that you had planted, everything that you were about to harvest, all of those months of work gone. And your food source is now gone. It's been ravaged by these insects. And this is a part of life. You know, this was something that just in that ancient Near Eastern culture, this could happen at any time. And God says he is forming this swarm of locusts. He is creating a swarm of locusts for the specific purpose of wiping out Israel's food source. And when are the locusts going to come? There's a time frame that's given here. Did you catch that? When are the locusts going to come and be unleashed upon Israel? It's after what? After the king's harvest or the king's mowings. What does that mean? Well, look at the bottom right of page 4. There's a box that will explain why this time frame is given is so important. The latter growth refers to the late spring crop of cattle feed, which is further described as coming after the king's mowings, an apparent reference to the royal right to tax the lands of farmers for fodder to feed the livestock maintained by the court. If the first cutting went to the court and the second crop to the locusts, Israel would be left destitute indeed. The April rains would have passed, and the long drought of summer, usually 6 months, would make further growth impossible. In other words, the devastation of this plague is that the king has already gotten his share of what you've planted. And so now the second share, all right, finally, that's what I get for me and my family, but then the locusts come and take it. And now you're forced... I forgot to put this up here, but they would be set loose on Israel during the latter growth after the king's mowings, which is important because, like I was just about to say, this would leave Israel with no food source before the long drought of summer. And so this is a horrible, horrible thing that God is about to unleash upon his people here. A horrible thing that will leave them without a food source for the long drought of summer, which means the only food that you're going to have is just whatever you can find or whatever someone's going to give you. But if these locusts are plagued to all of Israel, there's not going to be any food really to give. It's going to be a period of starvation that is going to afflict God's people. And so Amos sees this, and his response is to intercede on behalf of Israel. He intercedes on behalf of the northern kingdom to whom he's been preaching, and the very people who have been resisting him for his entire ministry. But he still intercedes for them. And he sees the result of the plague. It's important, I don't know if you caught this as we're reading, but if you look in verse 2, it says, when they, that is the locusts, had stripped the land clean, then Amos cries out. In other words, what God is showing him is not just, hey, I'm forming the locusts. Amos is taken outside of time, and he's shown from beginning to end the plague as Yahweh forms it all the way through to the end when the locusts have stripped the land clean. And so, again, being outside of time, he now just sees everything. And so he sees the land after the locusts are done and all of the horrible just aftermath of this plague. And so he's horrified by it. Amos is horrified by what God is showing him, because what God is showing him is a terrible thing. A terrible thing. And he also intercedes because he recognizes something that the northern kingdom had just not recognized. He also is going to intercede because he recognizes Israel's helplessness and insignificance before Yahweh. It's interesting what Amos says when he, in fact, he says this in the first two visions. When God shows him what he's about to do, Amos' response is, Yahweh forgive, how can Jacob stand? He's so small. That's kind of an interesting way to put it, isn't it? I mean, it's just kind of, if it strikes me anyway, it's a strange way of expressing Israel before God. And there's a lot of things we could probably unpack from that, but one thing I particularly want to draw your attention, what is so ironic about how Amos sees the northern kingdom of Israel versus how they saw themselves. We just talked about it in chapter 6. It really runs throughout Amos's book, but in chapter 6, there's some specific passage. How did the northern kingdom see themselves? strong conquerors. This is in what Amos says is in contrast to Israel's own view of themselves. In fact, would you go back to chapter 6? Let me just illustrate this to you. So remember what is said in chapter 6, verses 1 through 3. And just notice Israel's attitude about themselves, how they view themselves. Woe to you who are complacent in Zion, and you who feel secure on Mount Samaria, you notable men of the foremost nation to whom the people of Israel comes. Go to Calneh and look at it. Go from there to Great Hamath, and then go down to Gath in Philistia. Are they better off than your two kingdoms? Is their land larger than yours? You put off the day of disaster and bring near a reign of terror. And then skip down to verse 8 of chapter 6. The sovereign Yahweh is sworn by himself. Yahweh, God Almighty, declares, I abhor the pride of Jacob and detest his fortresses. And then skip down to verse 13 in chapter 6. You who rejoice in the conquest of Lodabar and say, did we not take Karnaim by our own strength? We talked about the wordplay that's used there that Amos is using in that section. But again, all of those verses just speaking to Israel's elevated view of themselves, where they just feel like we are a powerful people and we've really done it ourselves. Aren't we awesome? And yet Amos is here, and God is showing Amos, here's what I'm about to do to the northern kingdom. And Amos' reaction is, how can Jacob stand? He's so small. He is so insignificant. Amos is a man that understands what the real, what reality is. Reality is, Israel is not anything worth boasting about. And while the northern kingdom is waiting for the day of Yahweh, because they think it's going to mean their blessing, that was in chapter 5, and while they're sitting here high and mighty and thinking of themselves, man, we are just so great, Amos sees and recognizes we are nothing at all. And while Israel thinks that the day of disaster is not going to come to them, all the while they're thinking that, Yahweh is about to bring this plague of judgment upon them, and the only reason he doesn't is because of one man who speaks up and says, please don't do that. Would you please forgive? Because look at how small your people are. And God says, okay. So Amos performs an often overlooked role of a prophet. And that's of being an intercessor. I don't know about you, but when I think of what a prophet is, I don't think of this aspect of being a prophet. It's just something I've overlooked, just in my own Bible study. And yet, this is a major reason why someone is called a prophet in the Bible. In fact, the first person in the Bible who's called a prophet is Abraham. If you have your class materials there on the right of page 5, I put this verse there so we wouldn't have to turn to it. This is the first time someone in the Bible is called a prophet, and look at the reason why. Then God said to Abimelech in the dream, yes, I know that you have done this in the integrity of your heart, and it was I who kept you from sinning against me. That is, I didn't let you touch Sarah. When Abimelech took Sarah as his wife, not realizing that it was Abram's wife, he thought it was Abram's sister, because that's what Abram had told him. And so God says, that was I who kept you from sinning against me, therefore I did not let you touch her. Now then, return the man's wife, for he is a prophet, so that he will pray for you, and you shall live. And so again, just pointing out to you, this aspect of intercession for what it means to be a prophet is a major part of what it means to be a prophet. It's something that I've overlooked. And you see this with Abraham again in that passage that I just read from. You see it with Moses when he intercedes on behalf of Israel, where God is going to destroy Israel, and Moses says, please don't. And he intercedes for them, and God says, okay, fine. You see the same thing with Samuel in 1 Samuel 7, verse 5. We're going to talk about this at the end of class here as we draw some applications, but I just wanted to point that out to you. And the amazing thing here is that Amos says what he wants to say, and Yahweh relents. He says, okay, I'm not going to do this. This will not be, as the NIV translates it. And so Yahweh relents concerning the judgment he was preparing. And Israel is thus given more time to heed the messages of Amos' ministry. God shows mercy here. Now, that's the first vision. What comments or questions do you have on what we've talked about in this first vision before we jump into the second vision? Yes, sir, Mr. Willis.
There's a case in which God changed
his mind. Yep. We'll talk about that at the end here in just a second, where Mr. Willis just said, here's a case where God changed his mind. We'll talk about that here in a few minutes once we get past the second vision. Any other comments or questions on vision one? What's being told us there? Yes, sir.
Power of prayer,
yes, sir. Did you read ahead in my class materials? He's stealing my thunder up here. No, that's an excellent point. We're going to talk about that at the end. Yes, sir. That's an excellent point. All right. Any other comments or questions on vision one? All right. So let's look at vision two. Let's look at the second vision here. Read verses 4-6 with me. So in vision one, disaster has been avoided because of Amos. So now let's look in verse 4. This is what Sovereign Yahweh showed me. The Sovereign Yahweh was calling for judgment by fire. It dried up the great deep and devoured the land. Then I cried out, Sovereign Yahweh, I beg you, stop. How can Jacob survive? He is so small. So Yahweh relented. This will not happen either, Sovereign Yahweh said. So there we're given vision two. And in vision two, we're told that Yahweh is preparing a judgment by fire. Now, it's not 100% clear what the nature of this fire is. But what is clear is that the destruction of it is just going to be unimaginable. It is going to be a huge tragedy for Israel. In fact, this fire is so intense that Amos says it eats up the land and it dries up the sea. It's such an intense fire that even the ocean is dried up because of it. Now, I think there's some metaphorical language going on here, and I think just the point of what Amos is saying with this imagery is that he's saying we're going to lose both food and water here. That the nature of this fire, whatever it is, some have said maybe they think it's famine, or some maybe a literal fire, just whatever the nature of the fire, food and water are going to be lost because of it. And I know people don't take their water from the sea, but if you just think about it, if even the sea is dried up because of the intensity of this fire, what's that say about the wells or the springs in the land? Well, obviously, they're going to be licked up too by this fire that God is preparing. And so what's going to be the case here is just like with the locusts, you're looking at starvation and death from loss of food and water that's just going to now ravage God's people. Because this is what he's preparing to do to them because of all the things we've read thus far in Amos's book. And yet, Amos once again intercedes on behalf of Israel. And just like in vision one, Yahweh relents. He says, this too will not be. I'm not going to do this to my people. And so Israel is thus given more time to heed the messages of Amos' ministry. What questions or comments do you have on the second vision before we start to take some things from this that I just think are really, really powerful? What comments or questions do you have on the second vision here? All right. Well, here's what I want us to do here for the rest of our time together. There are some very powerful... One of the things I mentioned at the beginning of this quarter, I think it was the first class, if I remember correctly, was what are the things that we learn from the prophetic books? And one of the things that I mentioned was we learn about God, who God is relationally. Joey over there, for example, just pick on Joey. If I want to know Joey more, then I have to get to know him relationally. That means spending time with him, but I get to know him. What are his interests? What things make him mad? What things does he like? What's his sense of humor? Those types of things allow you to get to know somebody. Well, it's the same thing in the prophetic books. They're giving us information about who God is. Why does he react this way? What things does he like or dislike? What things make him joyful? What things make him angry? And we learn something very, very powerful about God in this section if we just kind of take a step back and look at what's really going on here. We've talked in this quarter a lot about the northern kingdom, sin, and why judgment is coming. I'm wanting to zoom out a little bit more here, because we've talked about that. And I want us to notice what God is doing with Amos, because it's something very powerful about his relationship to mankind. What has God done with Amos here? That's just so astounding. I mean, anything strike you about, if you just take a step back and look at what's going on, what has God done with Amos here? He's shown him the future. Yeah, you could say that. He's shown him the future. He had a relationship with him, personal relationship. And because of that, you could say, where has he brought Amos? He's made him his confidant. He has made him his confidant. And so one of the things that we see from this is God is willing to include human beings in his heavenly court. Think about that, what we're seeing here in Amos. The God of heaven and earth, who made human beings, has taken a human being and said, hey, come into my throne room. I want to show you what I'm doing, what I'm about to do. I just want to show you. I want to include you in it. That's astounding. That's amazing what God is doing here. And he doesn't just bring Amos in as his confidant. In other words, he doesn't just bring him in as an observer. Hey, I just want you to observe what I'm doing, Amos. What does he allow Amos to do when Amos is in his presence? Speak up. And so what we see here is that God doesn't just bring human beings into his heavenly court. He allows them to object to his decrees. Now, let me explain the word object, and in retrospect, maybe a better word would be appeal, just because object kind of has some negative connotations. It doesn't have to, but it can. I don't mean object in that Amos is saying, hey, God, that's not fair. You can't do that. No, Amos is objecting the way you would to a king. You know, if a king brings you into his court, and he's including you in his royal court, and he says, hey, this is what I'm going to do. And you're like, oh, my Lord, you are the king, but please, would you just consider this? Would you just allow me to speak this to you? Would you bear to hear your servant? And you respectfully give the king something to consider, something to think about as someone that the king has brought into his inner circle. So I mean object in that sense. And again, if it's more comfortable with the word appeal, maybe that's a better word. You can cross that out, write that in. But he's allowing Amos to speak his mind and say, Yahweh, would you please not do what you're about to do? He allows Amos to speak up. He brings a human being into his court and allows him to say, God, would you please not do this? And he doesn't respond by saying, hey, I didn't bring you in here to talk. You're here to watch. I'm God. You're a human. How dare you speak to me about what I'm doing? That's not his response. What's God's response to Amos? He relents. He listens to him. Now, I'll put this subpoint up here. He allows human beings to object to his decrees, though only to a point. And we'll see that when we get to chapter 8 in Vision 4. Only to a point. But the fact that this happens at all is astounding. And what you just said, it's not that God just brings human beings into his heavenly court. It's not that he then allows them to speak their mind and then he says, listen, I let you talk just so you can realize how foolish you are. He listens. He changes his plans based on what this human being asks of him, asks him to do. He changes his plan based on Amos's response. And if you just think about this, we see this throughout the Bible. There's other examples where God does this, where if probably because of familiarity, it's easy to miss how astounding it is what's being recorded, but we're so familiar with the story that we just kind of take it as, oh yeah, that's what happened. But think about it. You remember Abraham when God comes to Abram or Abraham and says, I'm going to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. What's he allow Abram to do? The barter with him. And he is patient, and he says to Abraham, you're right, if there's this many righteous people, I won't destroy the city. And Abraham, again, respectfully, like you would a king, It's like, oh, God, well, would you please consider, would you spare the city if it was, only 30 righteous, or whatever the numbers are, which escape me now, off the top of my head. And God keeps saying, yep, I'll do it, you're right. I'm not going to destroy it if there's that many righteous people. Well, God, would you do it if there's this many righteous people? No, I won't do it if there's that many. And what you have there in that scene, or what you have when God comes to Moses and says, I'm going to destroy Israel, and I'm going to use your seed through which I'm going to now bring about my plans. And Moses says, Yahweh, please don't do that. Would you please remember the promises that you made? And why should the Gentiles blaspheme your name? Because everyone's going to say, well, Yahweh just brought his people out of Egypt just to kill them. Don't let them say that about you. Would you please not do that? And in none of those scenes does Yahweh say, how dare you speak to me? I just told you what I'm going to do, and there's nothing you can say. I'm God. And so how dare you talk up? God listens to them. He listens. He's willing to converse with human beings. He's willing to come down to their level and actually include them in his plans. Now again, this only goes to a point. We'll see this in chapter 8. There does come a point where God says, no, this is what's going to happen. Because God does recognize way more than we will. And God does reach a point where he says, no, this is the course of action I'm going to take. But until it gets to that point, this is just one example in the Bible where God actually converses with his human creation and alters his plan based on what that human being asks him to do. And that is absolutely incredible. Remember what Amos has said in his book, where several times he's used hymn fragments to describe God. Now, he uses them for his rhetorical purpose of judgment. But for example, just to quote from one of the hymns, where Amos has said, Yahweh is the one who turns morning into darkness and pours out the waters on the surface of the earth. Just try to fathom that power and that omnipotence. And then look at this scene where God is standing before a human being, and a human being says, God, would you please not do this? And the God who turns the earth says, I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to do this because you said so. I won't bring this judgment on. That's incredible. That is amazing. That's absolutely astounding. What does that say about God? Let me just ask you before we just move forward. As you're looking at this scene and thinking about it, and even the other biblical examples that I mentioned, what does that say about the being who is the King of heaven and earth? About the God who created you and me and everything you can see? What does that say about Yahweh, about him? He's personal. Yeah, he's personal. What else? Yeah, that with the parable of the widow and the judge, the magistrate, where she keeps, you know, begging the evil judge, and he finally just listens to her because he's just annoyed with her. And Jesus' point is, look, if even an evil judge will meet your petition based on repeated appeals, how much more is your good father going to listen to you and make that and listen to your appeals? One of the ways that is there a hand up? Did I see something? Yeah, Adam?
Well, I think it also shows his patience, his willingness to hold off and give people as much time as possible.
Yeah, his patience. His patience, wanting to give human beings as much time as possible in order to make changes. And really, everything you've said, I've kind of summarized it this way here. This is the extent to which God seeks relational interactions with mankind. That's just how I kind of summarize some of the things that you've said. This is the extent he will go. He wants a relationship with human beings so much and loves us so much that he will lower himself to converse with human beings. And he will listen to us where we say, God, would you please do this? And there are times, not every time, obviously, but there are times where in his wisdom, he recognizes, you know what? I'm going to listen to you because I care. I care about your feelings. I care about what you're saying. I'm going to listen to you. I'm not going to do this. That just speaks volumes about who God is. Now, I recognize that there are aspects of this situation in Amos that are unique to Amos, that are unique to him and his role of an inspired prophet. There's certainly aspects that are unique to him in that respect. But I want to continue this train of thought because, broadly speaking, this is applicable to all of us. God wants to go to this extent to seek a relationship with mankind, and really what he's doing with Amos, it shows us what this gentleman up here just mentioned a few minutes ago. Brethren, prayer is a means to this end. Prayer is a means by which God is seeking that relationship. Think about what prayer is. The God of heaven and earth has told us in his word, we'll look at some examples in just a second. He's told us in his word, I want you to speak to me. I want you to bring your petitions to me because I care and because I will act for you in his wisdom and in his time, but he will act for us. That's what God's told us to do. I want to look at three passages with you just where this is illustrated. By coincidence, they all come from Paul. I wasn't meaning to make them all come from Paul. But let's go here. Would you turn to 2 Corinthians 1 for me? Because I want to show you something. I'll get you in 1 second, Mr. Willis. I want to show you how what Amos is doing with God and what that shows about God seeking a relationship with human beings, how that applies to all of us through prayer, because prayer is where we enter the throne room of the God of heaven and earth, and he stops to listen to each one of us individually. And that's incredible. Yes, sir, Mr. Willis. I'm going to say something about that in just a second. Would you hold that thought for just a second? Because after we look at these verses, I'm going to approach that comment that you just said. So let me look at 2 Corinthians with you here, 2 Corinthians 1. And just look at what Paul says in verses 10 through 11 and what Paul is assuming here about the relationship between human beings and God. God has delivered us from such a deadly peril, and he will deliver us again. On him we have set our hope that he will continue to deliver us as you help us by your prayers. Then many will give thanks on our behalf for the gracious favor granted us in answer to the prayers of many. What's Paul assuming here in what he's saying to the Corinthians? What's his worldview on prayer and how it binds human beings to God? What's his assumption? You're going to pray for us, and God's going to listen to you. And when he acts in response to your prayers, it's just going to cause people to give thanks to him, all to his glory. Paul is assuming that human beings can approach God in prayer, and the God of heaven and earth will listen and will then respond to those petitions, to those prayers. Let me show you another in 1 Timothy. Flip over to 1 Timothy 2. First Timothy 2 and verses 1 and 2. And again, just think about how Paul is thinking about prayer here. I urge then, first of all, that petitions, prayers, intercession, and thanksgiving be made for all people, for kings and all those in authority, that we may live peaceful and quiet lives in all godliness and holiness. Again, Paul is assuming us as human beings, we as human beings, can approach God with petitions and even intercessions. Paul just treats that as a given. He doesn't have to explain it to Timothy. He just says, I want you to intercede on behalf of other human beings. Not that we can do what Christ did. It's not that. But like Amos, we can pray for other human beings and say, God, I know that this person is in a bad place and I'm just praying for them. Would you please act on their behalf? Would you please act that they would see the truth and that they would come to a knowledge of you. Similar to what Amos must have been doing for the northern kingdom. And Paul says, I want you to do that because it works. Because God responds. to those things in prayer. And then one more. Would you go to Philemon? Flip over just a few pages to Philemon. And look at verse 22. And this sounds like such a simple thing, but think about how Paul must have thought of prayer to even say this in his letter. And one more thing. Prepare a guest room for me because I hope to be restored to you in answer to your prayers. And again, Paul just assuming here, I know you're praying for me to be restored to you, and I have confidence that's going to happen because I know the God who you're praying to. I know He listens to human beings, and He responds to them. And so I hope to be restored to you through your prayers. Now, we can't understand how this works. Because like Mr. Willis was saying, if God's outside of time, and Shane's talked about this in his Who is God class, if God's outside of time, then we're bound by time. And so some of this is hard for us to understand. Well, how can He, if He knows what we would call the future, well, then isn't it just that He already knows what He's going to do, and so He just does what He's going to do, and for whatever reason, just makes it look like He's responding to the petitions of human beings? Here's what I would say to that. God chose how to reveal Himself to us. He chose how to reveal Himself to us. For example, in the Bible, He just chooses to reveal Himself as a He. Now, is He really a male in the sense that no, but He had to reveal Himself somehow so we could have a mental conception, and He chose, I'm going to reveal Myself with the gender male. And that's how then we conceive of Him and speak about Him. He could have chosen a female if He wanted to. He had some reason to. He could have said, no, think of Me as a she. That's how I want you to mainly conceptualize Me, just as a she, so your human minds could understand who I am and what I'm doing. He could have done that. He chose not to. He chose to reveal Himself as man. Well, think about this. God chose in His Word not to really get into some of the philosophical questions that man just kind of wonders about, which are good questions. They're good questions to kind of wrestle with. But in these passages, Paul doesn't bother to get into the philosophy of it. He just recognizes, here's how God's revealed Himself. He responds to human beings' petitions. Period. Case closed. That's how He wants us to think of Him. Or when Jesus said, this is how I want you to pray. Our Father who art in heaven, and then the last part of the prayer is, would You please give us our daily bread, and please lead us not into temptation, deliver us from the evil one. Where Jesus is assuming God's going to respond to your prayer. He knows what needs you have. He's a Father who wants to provide for His children. That's how He wants you to conceive of Him. That's how He wants you to conceive of prayer. And so what I would say is, as we're looking at these things about prayer here, looking about what Amos is doing, yes, there's going to be philosophical questions we ultimately can't answer because God's outside of time. But here's what we know. In His Word, He chose to reveal Himself to us as one who stops and listens to man and then sometimes will say, I'm going to do what You've asked. Because He's a generous and merciful God. Now we can debate and say, well, but did He really change His mind? Or did He already know what He was going to do? Personally, my answer is, that doesn't matter. How's the Bible revealing? Because that's how He chose to reveal Himself. That's how He chose to say, this is what I want you to think about it. You spoke, I listened, and I acted on your behalf. Because I love you, and I want a relationship with you. And that's how I want you to think of prayer. Because I am a God who listens and responds. We can't answer how that all works, but we know how it's been revealed and how God wants us to think about it. Yeah, Adam?
Well, and I don't want to put too much of a humanity brush on the whole thing, but two things. Is one, I was thinking, if He said that He was going to relent on something and then He was going to do it anyway, he knew He was going to do it anyway, and just decided, well, I'll just placate Him. I mean, effectively, that doesn't make what He's saying true. And if he's always truth and all that, I mean, there has to be some changing of His mind.
Yeah.
Now, and also on that scene, as a parent, if you have kids and they say, oh, okay, I won't do that anymore, all right, I'll let it get by this one time, and I won't punish you, and we won't punish you.
Yeah.
And I'm going to have to punish you later. Same mentality, I think, maybe that he you know, yes, I will relent on this decision, but most likely it's going to have to come to fruition at some point.
Here, yeah, and ultimately our analogies and our thoughts are going to fall short because we just can't understand it. But here's my point. Here's just what I'm saying. According to the revealed, inspired word of Amos, why did God not bring judgment on Israel those first two times? What's the reason God wanted us to know why he didn't do it? Because Amos interceded, and he listened to Amos. And what I'm trying to show here is, that's what he does with all of us with prayer. That aspect isn't unique to Amos. Now, Amos's role as prophet is unique, an inspired prophet, certainly. But the fact that God listens to human beings isn't just evident in Amos. It's evident all throughout the Bible. And in those passages we just read where Paul's saying, God listens to you. The creator of heaven and earth, when you pray to him, he is listening. You are in his throne room, so to speak. And he wants to hear what you have to say because he acts on behalf of human beings according to his wisdom. But he does act based on the petitions of human beings. And I think just real quick to finish up here, one last thing we see about this, about God here, is that although God will punish sin, he prefers to show mercy. Israel did not deserve the mercy extended to them in these first two visions. They didn't repent. They didn't do anything to bring this on. The only reason God relented was because one man interceded and pled on their behalf. And God is a being who would rather show mercy, and so he said, I won't do this. I'm going to give them more time, like somebody mentioned in class earlier. Now again, that only reaches a point. God won't be taken advantage of. And we'll see that later in these visions, where the time of intercession does stop. But up until this point, God is doing everything he can to give Israel more time, because he is a being who doesn't enjoy punishing sinners. He wants them to come to him, and he would rather show mercy. And so long as that is in so long as the scales of justice aren't tipped too much in the way of judgment, he will show mercy. But again, once those scales tip too much, the time of judgment comes, and we'll read about that in the future visions. But I think this section here with what Amos is doing in these first two visions really says a lot about who our God is and what he will do with you when you enter his throne room to pray for him and give him your petitions or make your intercessions on behalf of those you know who maybe are under God's judgment or his watchful eye of being in sin, but yet you can intercede on their behalf like Amos did, and God listens to that. And we can ask him to listen to the petitions of our hearts. Thank you for your comments tonight. So we're going to continue chapter 7 and finish it up on Sunday morning. Appreciate you being here tonight.